This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hello everyone.
大家好.
Selamat datang.
Konnichiwa.
Hola.
안녕하세요.
Assalamualaikum.
And kia ora. Connecting Cultures Futures is a show by and for the beautiful and diverse multicultural people of Dunedin. Join me every Friday noon for Connecting Cultures Futures on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM, podcast on oar.org.nz. And you are listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM. Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to Connecting Cultures Features, a show by, for, and about the multicultural people of Dunedin in New Zealand. Today, I am here with Aisha. She is part of the Dunedin Pakistan Society, which is a newly established society, but she's been in New Zealand for a while, and I'm really excited to have a chat with her all about her journey. Kia ora, Aisha.
Kia ora, Arina.
Thank you for being here today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And yourself?
Yes, it's a very good day. Even though it's winter, it feels a bit warm. And I wonder why, you know, it's the first day of winter. But how are you feeling?
I'm good. I'm really excited to be here. And I'm very thankful to be here. Yes. Mm. So thank you so much for providing the opportunity for being here.
Thank you. And I really want to get to know you because I feel like there's a lot of things we are passionate about together because you were a trained psychologist.
Yes.
I'm not a trained psychologist, but I love psychology. I did that as my major in university. So there's so much about that we can talk about. Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yes, sure. Kia ora koutou, New Zealand. Greetings and assalamu alaikum. May peace and blessings be upon all of you. I am Aisha Nisar Qureshi and I am from Pakistan. I, along with my family, which comprises of myself, my three daughters, Anam, Alina and Alia, and my husband, Agha Shiraz Hanif, we came to New Zealand in 2019 to pursue my PhD studies. I completed my PhD last year in September, and now I'm working as a community stroke advisor at the Stroke Foundation, New Zealand. And before coming to New Zealand, I was educated and trained as a clinical psychologist in my country, Pakistan. I have served as a clinical psychologist in a public sector hospital in Pakistan. I've learned and I've grown with a variety of clients who had minor mental health and psychological issues, ranging to some severe ones with severe psychotic issues. The hallmark of my career was when I was employed as part of a special mission when Pakistan was hit by one of the debilitating earthquakes in 2005. I was employed in Kashmir to work with the earthquake survivors. And that was the time when I helped people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorders. And because the earthquake was so severe in the intensity that the death toll was about 80,000, as far as I remember, and the people who were left with residual disabilities were about 70,000. Yeah, so I was working with mental and psychological well-being of people at that time. After serving in this role, I took a break for a number of years from my career, because that was the time when I was hit by one of the life's curveballs. My father was diagnosed of a terminal cancer, and myself and my three sisters and my mother, we were his primary carer. So I took a break from my career. Yeah. After that, I moved to Saudi Arabia, where I worked as a lecturer in the University of Jazan. So I served as a lecturer at the College of Public Health and Tropical Medicine for about 6 years. Then in 2019, I decided to move to New Zealand to do my PhD. Yes, so this was a brief snapshot of what I had been doing in my life.
That is such important things to mention, and I'm glad that you somehow managed to put that in 3 minutes.
Yeah, this is part of our training, you know, the PhD training, doing 3 minute thesis competition and all that. Yeah,
just
so
highlight.
It comes from that training.
Yeah,
I must admit.
Highlight the most important things that happen in your life somehow in 3 minutes. Well, we really appreciate you sharing your introduction that way, because now we know what to expect from this conversation.
Oh, thank you.
So, yes, you've been a psychologist, and especially in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And I think the most important part was helping the earthquake survivors, right? Were you aware that that was where you were heading? Because was it a surprise that you had to help earthquake survivors? Because, you know, no one knew that it was going to happen.
Yes, it was one of the severest adversity that I had ever witnessed in my life. And, of course, that was a trauma that came as a surprise to all of us as a nation. And
were you affected by it?
No, I wasn't, because I was in the capital city. The earthquake was in the capital city as well, but the casualties were not in the capital. The casualties were mostly in the northern areas of Pakistan.
Mm.
And as they say, that sometimes there are blessings in disguise. So that adversity, I think, provided us the opportunity to give back to the community in whatever way we can. And I will talk about what is the history of giving back to the community in my country later on. But yes, just letting you know at this stage very briefly that I was surprised to see how people came out to help all their community members, including myself. Yeah, so yes, to answer your question, it was a surprise that came, but then it was a blessing in disguise that God provided us the opportunity to help people who were the most needy at that time.
Mm.
And the other thing is that I got to learn a lot from that opportunity. I think if it wasn't the earthquake, I wouldn't be able to work with persons with disabilities. So that was my first starting point to work with persons with disability in my life. And yeah.
That's a good point to mention, because now in Dunedin, you are currently working at...
Yes, I'm working as a community stroke advisor at the Stroke Foundation.
Mm.
Yes, my work largely includes working with persons with disabilities. Not all people end up with disability as an impact of stroke, but most of the people do. So yes, there is a sequence of events, a chain of events that has led to this career, that also I'm going to speak later about how I started my PhD and how I landed a job in community work. But yes, it certainly relates to what I learned, how my passion grew, how my motivation grew when I started my work with persons with disabilities in Pakistan.
Have you always wanted to be a psychologist? Like, looking back, like, you know, after high school, before starting university, was that like the course that you always wanted to do?
Yes. I was always inspired by how different people think. So the starting point of my interest was observing people on how two people would react differently to two things, and how two people would think differently about an event, about an experience. Yeah, so to answer your question, I was always interested in studying thought processes, human behavior. And the reason why I studied psychology was firstly the fact that higher education and academia, it runs in my blood. I belong to a family of educationists and academicians. My father was a dean faculty of social sciences in Allama Iqbal Open University. It's a renowned public sector university in Pakistan. So he was the dean of the social sciences. So also my love for human behavior, social sciences, psychology is partly social sciences and partly health sciences as well. Yeah, so that love stems from the inheritance of what my father used to do and how my father was engaged with education. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's that as well. And then my own passion for understanding the thought processes and feelings and emotions in human beings.
Mm.
Yeah.
Was there a personal story behind why that was a interest back then?
There is no personal story until when I did my master's in psychology, but definitely there is a personal story when I did my PhD and how and what led to my PhD. Until my master's in psychology, not a personal story, but just a personal interest of observing people, what they do and how they do. And that led to an increasing interest in studying psychology.
Hmm. I just love talking to people who study psychology because they're all very different.
Yes.
Because psychology is very broad. I think I was interested in psychology because of just the way women behave.
Yeah.
Because I was so interested with gender studies as well. And yeah. I couldn't access that in Malaysia because there's no, you know, it's quite taboo there to be speaking about gender issues.
Yeah.
So that's why I came to New Zealand for that. So, it's very important that you share that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm. Let's talk about your culture, and then we'll come back to talk about your PhD after.
Yes, sure.
So what would you say are Pakistani values that you've hold growing up in your family?
Because Pakistan is predominantly a Muslim country, as you would know, we follow Islam, and because cultural values arise from what religion we follow. So most of our culture is embedded in Islamic values. And I'm very proud to say as a Muslim that the values of Islam are the values of empathy, the values of kindness, the values of generosity, and the values of respect for each and every person, irrespective of their race, religion, and caste. We were brought up in my family and in my culture with these values, and we try our best to transform the same values to our next generation as well. To answer your question, our cultural values are Islamic values that we were brought up with, and those values, as I said, are the values of human rights and human respect all over the world.
So when did you come to New Zealand?
Well, I came to New Zealand in 2019. It was June 2019 when I came to New Zealand.
So you had a few months before the lockdown to settle in.
Yes.
What was that like? Why New Zealand?
Okay. Are you interested in listening to a story?
Yes. That is why we're here, for stories.
Okay. As I said, before coming to New Zealand, I was in Saudi Arabia working as a full-time lecturer in psychology and mental health at the School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine in Jazan University. It was not until I experienced another curveball that hit my life. And that was actually the inspiration for embarking me on a research journey. My mother had a severe stroke, and I became her primary family carer a few years before 2019. And I still remember that time in the hospital that after receiving acute rehab treatment from a private hospital in Islamabad, Pakistan, we were told with some discharge notes in the physician's hand, and I was advised that, look, this is what it is, and you have to learn to cope with it. We were not able to recover from the aftershocks of the first stroke, that a second massive stroke happened in a few months' time, leaving mom in a debilitating physical and mental health condition. My mother was a young woman, very energetic, independent in all her activities of daily living, but she had just become the shell of who she was when she had stroke. And while I was navigating my role as a family carer, the closer I looked, the more I saw that family carers are playing a crucial role in our health and social care systems, especially when it comes to long-term conditions like stroke. Our health systems do not have the capacity to keep people diagnosed with stroke in hospitals for a long time. And that's the reason they are discharged back into the community to live in their own homes. And then they are the sole responsibility of the family carers who provide long-term support to the person who is affected with stroke. And I think it won't be an exaggeration to say that if the family carers were to stop caring today, our health and social care systems would just fall over. This was the starting point and the realization of the fact that how important building the resilience and well-being of family carers is for our healthcare system. This sparked an interest in me to how better support the family carers in their role so that they can provide the long-term sustainable care to the person with stroke. I drafted my research proposal on the resilience and well-being of family carers, and thankfully it was accepted by the School of Physio and the University of Otago. Dr. Lee Hale was my primary supervisor, and Lee, if you are hearing this at this time, I'm still very, very thankful, and I have huge respects for you. If you were not there, I wouldn't be here today. she opened the door for me. And yes, so this PhD proposal got accepted. I got admission in PhD with a fully funded doctoral scholarship. And I came to New Zealand in 2019 to start my PhD.
Wow.
Yeah, so this was the personal experience. Yeah, sorry, I sometimes become very touchy and emotional with this experience.
And you should. I mean, it's such a important part of your life. And, you know, just as a Muslim, I believe that things happen for a reason and you just don't know what God plans for you.
Yes.
So just hearing your life story, it sounds like reading a book, you know, you just don't know until it happens. And suddenly when you look back, like, oh, that's why, you know.
This is also part of my research training that we were always taught to tell your research in the form of a storytelling format.
Yeah.
So people can relate to it and people find it interesting. So yes, hats off to my research training.
Yeah. Well, and somehow you've ended up working at Stroke Foundation.
Yes. So when I finished my, because in my PhD, my PhD was all about building a resilience intervention for family carers of stroke survivors. My intervention was called as strengths-based resilience intervention. I will just tell very briefly about what that intervention program was. So this program was based on the science of positive psychology, based on the narrative that we can try to improve our resilience and improve our well-being by looking at what is right in our life rather than what is wrong. Mm. And as the positive psychology scientists say that working on strengths is as efficacious as working on our symptoms. And this is scientifically proven. And in my research, I also found out that the strengths-based resilience intervention that helped family carers to foster their resilience by working on their strengths was a very favorable and positive approach to build their resilience. So because I was working with the Stroke Foundation all during my PhD tenure, I had good networking with the foundation. And thanks to the Stroke Foundation, they supported my work, they owned my work, they regarded my work as important and provided me all the necessary support that I wanted during my PhD. Soon after I completed my PhD, I was employed by the Stroke Foundation as a community stroke advisor. So it's been almost 6 months now that I'm working as a community stroke advisor at the Stroke Foundation. Yes.
I'm speechless, but in my heart, I'm saying, you know, alhamdulillah, you know, there's so, like, I feel very blessed with, I feel like there's so much blessings in this story that
we have to remember. Yes.
Mm.
Yes. And another thing I want to say is that, I don't know, it works very closely for me, and I'm sure it's relevant to most of us that the legacies we carry from our previous generation, from our parents, from our grandparents, they matter a lot. Like, I would say that I carried the legacy of the love of learning, perseverance, grit, hard work, love of academia from my parents. And that worked for me. And that was my strength in my journey. And so other than that, I had always tried to keep my connection with academia alive because, as I said, academia is in my blood. I am working part-time with the Open Polytech of New Zealand as a part-time faculty member in social health and well-being. Yeah, so I nurture that strength of mine, which I find in teaching and educating. Yeah, so that's another route that I follow for working with academia. Yeah.
Because, you know, your research was to support family carers, right?
Yes.
If you can look back to past you when you were caring for your mother,
Yeah.
What would you advise her with the knowledge you have now on how to maintain resilience, and how can you support her back then?
My research was on the resilience and well-being of family carers. And what I have read in the literature and what I found through my research is the more resilient, the more well family carers are, the better care they will be able to provide to the person with stroke. Because persons with stroke, and this is well evident in the literature as well, not only persons with stroke, so all people with long-term conditions, they like to live in their own homes, they like to live in their own community, they don't want to go into care homes, they don't want to be hospitalized for the lifetime, because living in the community gives them empowerment, it gives them independence, it gives them independent decision-making ability.
Belonging as
yes.
well, just feel safe.
Yes, love and belongingness and yeah. So, going back to your question of how I would support, if I would know all those resilience skills and toolkits that I have learned now, I think I would have been in a much stronger, better, and healthier position to support my mom. And I would admit that although I was a mental health person, I was a psychology graduate, a practitioner, I used to teach people about psychological well-being, but I was given a lesson of my own when I became the family carer. And I would say that I learned some bad coping mechanisms when I did not have the right tools to build my own resilience. So if it was back then, I would say I would be much more empowered with the right tools in my toolkit to deal with what had come my way.
It's good that the toolkit exists now. So for
yes.
people out there who are family carers, they can learn from that.
Yes, definitely. And adversity never discriminates anyone. I mean, no one is immune to getting unexpected bad things in life. So I think it's the right time we prepare ourselves with the right tools. Pandemic is an example. It was so uncertain, traumatic pandemic that happened to all of us, and it's still lingering on our shoulders. So yes, it's the right time that people get prepared with those right skills and tools in their hands to be resilient. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Aisha.
You're welcome.
You know, just hearing your journey makes it so inspiring. And
thank you.
It's beautiful to see how, you know, your life worked out in the end.
Yes, thank you.
So now you're in New Zealand.
Yes.
Since 2019,
yes.
you've got family here.
Yeah.
How are you settling down in Aotearoa?
Well, all migrant families have their stories. I wouldn't say that it was an easy decision and easy journey. It had its own ups and downs. It was a roller coaster. But my journey was filled of my belief in my faith and hope. I had always believed in the fact that with every hardship comes ease, and I think it's very clearly indicated in Quran as well.
Yeah.
So this was my faith whenever I had encountered a difficult phase settling in the real beginning of my chapter of migration. And I always had this hope that it's going to be a brighter outcome for me. And for my kids, they grew with me really. And as I always say, that children are far more resilient than adults. Their brains have, well, adult brains also have the adaptability and plasticity to adapt with the environment, but children are more faster at that. And the fact that Aotearoa is very supportive, is very safe, is very positive. So all those vibes that I got in the beginning when I came to New Zealand for the first year, everything was positive. And there is no doubt in the fact that there were struggles. And I knew about those beforehand. I was very fortunate to have the support of family and friends who were very supportive. All the colleagues and my supervisors in the School of Physio, they were all very, very supportive. So my safety net and my support system was quite stronger. And yeah, I tried my best to make it a positive journey rather than being anxious and transferring my anxiety to my children as well. So I tried not to do that. It was a difficult journey just for the first 1 year to settle down kids and to start with everything. Yeah, but then, as I said, with every hardship comes ease. So it got easier and easier.
I love that quote that's in the Quran. It's like, you know, as Muslims, we believe that. And I think, you know, something we can relate to.
Yes.
It's such an important part of life.
Yes.
Being Muslim and reading those in the Quran, you just realize that life is so much bigger than what you think it is.
Yes.
You know, that small hardship is actually nothing in 30 years when you look back.
Yes, yes.
I
certainly agree with that. And again, I would say that the teachings and the values with which we grow up, they matter a lot. They are in your mind, they are in your thoughts, they are in the behavior that you express. And yeah, those Islamic and cultural values of hard work, grit, positivity, kindness were always with me in my journey. Yeah.
Yeah. You are also raising 3 daughters here in the
Netherlands?
Yes. Yeah. I'd love to talk about motherhood if you're open to it, because it's, you know, on top of studying and having your own personal journeys to work through, you're also raising the next generation.
Yes, yes.
Do you have any, you know, advice for mothers out there, who, especially migrant mothers, who are trying to figure out their life but also support their children?
Yes. From my experience and what I see around me in my community, the first thing I would like to say is that we are the role models for our children, and the way we talk to them, the way we behave with them, they imitate and replicate everything. And if mothers are anxious, they transfer that anxiety in kids and raise anxious children. This is scientifically proven, and research supports the fact. So becoming anxious is not a bad thing, but again, I would say that learning the right coping mechanisms, empowering yourselves with the right toolkit is the way to cope with the anxiety, rather than transferring all that anxiety to younger kids that may have harmful impacts for them all through their life. And the other thing, as I said, that kids are very, very resilient, far resilient than what our thoughts are. Sometimes we think that we are in a guilt, that because we are progressing with our own goals, leaving behind our upcoming generation. But let me tell you that I have seen in my experience that your kids grow with you. They see what they are, what you are doing. They owe that you are doing the hard work, like my kids did. And one of my youngest, she still sometimes come to me, and when if I'm working late in the evening, she would come to me and say, "Oh, are you still writing that same big book that you were writing for the last 3 years?" He's referring to my PhD thesis, because I always used to say to her that, "Look, Mom is doing PhD and writing a big book." So, yeah, that gives me the confidence that she has registered that in her mind that I did a hard work, and I know that I have transferred that value to my kids rather than transferring my anxiety to them. So, yes, that works.
That is such a good moment to reflect on, because it means, you know, they associate you in the big book. And that's very good advice as well.
Yeah.
One more thing that I wanted to ask in relation to mental health and well-being is, what do you do for yourself, you know, not as a mother, but like for your own self? What are the things you do to maintain a healthy well-being?
Right. Okay. So different people have different perspectives to well-being, different approaches to well-being. For me, my resilience is my well-being. And first thing, I have a very clear sense of purpose. And that sense of purpose is giving back to the community. And I'm very, very clear about it. Ever since I started my career, this was in my mind. This was my purpose. And that's perhaps also one of the reasons I've always worked in a helping profession. So having a clear sense of purpose. Now, when I work as a community stroke advisor, that clear sense of purpose is my strength. I know that I am making a difference in people's lives and I'm giving back to community. Another sense of purpose that we just started as a team is Dunedin Pakistan Society, that will, I'm sure you will come later to talk about it. That is also built with the philosophy of giving back to the community, creating flourishing communities, and creating resilient communities. So yes, having a clear sense of purpose fosters my resilience and well-being. The other thing is that the concept of mental agility is very clear to me. I know what is it that I can change or do something about, and I accept what is it that I cannot do anything about. And then I don't have to beat myself up for that. I realize the fact that I'm not a superman who has to control the world with all the superpowers. So I am a human being and I know my limitations. There are some things that I am able to do and change, and the others I'm not able to do anything about or change. So yes, it's that thing. And the third thing, which fosters my resilience and well-being, is I reach out for help. I help people and I reach out for help for myself. I've got a support network of family and friends around me, and I know how important it is for connecting with others, for our belongingness, for the human need of love and care and regard and respect. So yes, I make sure that I am visible in my community, and people know who I am. So when I need some help and support, I can reach out to people, and I don't feel any shame or guilt in reaching out to people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wrote all these notes down. because I think okay. it's so important that yes. I also reflect on this.
Yes.
Especially the clear sense of purpose.
Yes.
Because I think I know what my purpose is, but I kind of want to make sure I know it every day so that it helps me get through the day.
Yes.
Because sometimes, like, okay, you do that, but you don't. You just don't think about it every day. And yes. then it just slips out of your mind and you just forget about it.
Yes. And if you are interested, I'm very, very happy to pass on some resources to you that will further increase your confidence in how the scientific research has backed this concept that how having a clear sense of purpose in life improves the well-being and resilience and keeps us in a good emotional regulation. So it is scientifically proven. There are experiments that people have done. Yeah.
I would love that. And maybe I'll share with the listeners as well.
Of course.
Thank you, Aisha. That was a very insightful and cup-filling conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We might go on a song break before we talk about Dunedin Pakistan Society. Yes. So we, you know, change the mood for a bit because feeling very relaxed with the conversation about well-being, as it should be.
Yes.
We might play Dil Se Pakistan. Do you want to share a bit about that?
Yes. So Dil Se Pakistan is a purely patriotic national song sung by a very young singer and musician. It just gives the message of love for the country, the feeling of belongingness, identity for one's own country. And yeah, it just gives the message of respect for one's own country, no matter in which condition or situation the country is at the moment.
Yeah. Wow, that's a beautiful story to bring as well. So we'll be right back after the song break.
Jaise chalta hai
And you're back on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. I'm Arina, and you're here with me for Connecting Cultures Features, a show by, for, and about the multicultural people of Dunedin. I'm here with Aisha. Hello.
Hi.
Hey. Thank you so much for bringing us that song. I really appreciate you bringing us your patriotic Pakistani music.
This is something we always want to remind ourselves when living away from families. So I thought this is a good opportunity to do that. Mm. So thank you for that, Arina.
Thank you. Let's talk about the Dunedin Pakistan Society. So it's newly established, but, you know, it's not like new because you know everyone in there. Mm. Can you share with us about it?
Right. So there is again a story.
Mm.
Would you want
me
to start?
We love stories,
oh, thank you. Okay, so Dunedin Pakistan Society is a newly established community services society. So when I say that it's a newly established society, it does not imply that people who own this society are also new to Dunedin. So the people who own this society and who did all the hard work for establishing this society were a group of like-minded people who had always believed in the power of giving back to the community. We always had our belief in the fact that how we humans are with each other helps us in flourishing ourselves and the flourishing of our communities around us. Other than that, as I also mentioned in the parts of my interview, that the legacy and the heritage that we carry from our culture values means a lot for what we are doing in the community. So Pakistan has got a rich history of philanthropy and charitable giving, whether it's in the form of cash, in-kind donations, or by donating their time. And fueling this culture of generosity is the Islamic emphasis on giving in the form of zakat, sadaqah, and fitrana, as you would know, as well as other moral and social factors and a deeply rooted sense of compassion towards community members. My country has a history of well-known social service workers and philanthropists, such as Abdul Sattar Idhi. He was a man of generous character who was running a welfare service, and he and his wife together both have passed away now, but they have contributed to such acts of kindness like free ambulatory services in the country, providing shelter to homeless people in the society. So yes, that was Abdul Sattar Idhi. Also, I would now remember Zafar Abbas, who was a social worker, and he has done a lot of social and community work in the country. I would also like to remember Dr. Ruth Pfau, who was partly a German and partly a Pakistani. She was a medical doctor and who moved from Germany to serve in Pakistan for the people suffering from leprosy. And yes, she has done a lot of community and social service work for the benefit of the community. The point that I'm trying to raise is that we, the group of community members who have established Dunedin Pakistan Society, have inherited this rich heritage of philanthropy and community services from our identity as Pakistanis, and who Pakistanis are and what they do in the community and how they contribute in the community. Before the establishment of Dunedin Pakistan Society, we were working on a very low-key level in the community and social services. For example, we had been volunteering with some old homes. We had been visiting residents in the old home, providing them companionship and time. Not only the adults, our kids were also doing that with us. They would take their storybooks to read to the older citizens at the afternoon tea time. We had raised funds for Pakistanis when there was earthquake last year. When there were floods and Pakistan was in the dire need of donations. So we had been doing this kind of social and community work in the community. And this was, as I said, this was our sense of purpose and it was giving us self-fulfillment. And we decided that we will emerge with a more stronger identity to take this work forward in the community. Yes, so it was this with this background that Dunedin Pakistan Society has been established. And I am going to be the chairperson of this society. And I will not talk in more detail about the Dunedin Pakistan Society now because I am aiming to do another program on radio, so it would not do justice with that program if I narrate all the story here.
It's good to share that, you know, we are really looking forward to have a Dunedin Pakistan Society program RFM as part of Connecting Cultures.
Thank you.
But because we are running out of time today.
Yes, sure thing.
There's so much more that we could talk about and people are looking forward to it then.
Yes.
So thank you so much, Aisha. I feel really blessed to hear your story and to share it with other people as well. And I'm sure people are really happy to hear from you too.
Thank you, Arina. It's just an awesome opportunity that you provided. I'm very happy to connect with you. I'm very happy to share my story here. And I look forward to lots of future collaborations.
Inshallah.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM.
نظم و ضبط کو اپنا dekhna gawana mat daulat e ki logo ye watan amanat hai aur tum ami logo
mere karwan hum rooh e karwan tum hum to sirf un baat hai असल दास्तां तुम
मेरे कारवां हम थे रूहे कारवां तुम हो हम तो सिर्फ उन बात थे असल दास्तां तुम हो
नफरतों के दरवाजे खुद पे बंद ही रखना
इस वतन के परचम को सरबुलंद
पास बार ठहरे फिर ये अहद करते हैं तेरे मान की खातिर तेरी आन की खातिर ये लहू बहा देंगे अपनी जान उठा देंगे हम जो पास बार ठहरे
दिस पॉडकास्ट वॉज प्रोड्यूस्ड बाय ORFM Dunedin विद सपोर्ट फ्रॉम New Zealand On the Air.